And take our seats, we will get started on today's agenda. Okay, this morning we are going to start out with the Habitat Report, which I am assuming is an update on where we are moving ahead with the Omnibus Habitat Amendment. Dave Preble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What the schedule calls for is an overview of the committee's draft habitat management area options and dedicated habitat research area options, and it also says the council may provide guidance to the Habitat Committee on further development of these options. So that's our basic task for the day. Since the last council meeting, the Habitat Committee met on December 4th, and as far as the gear modification options are concerned, the committee did not recommend moving forward with any of the trawled ground cable recommendations. But they did request that the PDT develop a data collection protocol to enable such information to be used in further management actions. The PDT felt that our current ability to properly manage gear modification of that type, trawl ground cable links, was not sufficient to use in management at this time. So they decided to request that we come up with the data collection protocol. They also suggested that these gear modifications options be made frameworkable. And moving on beyond that, committee also asked the PDT to evaluate modified boundaries for the Great South Channel areas in response to a problem that evolved from the general category small boat scallopers. There was an area down there that I'm sure Michelle can show you that needed to be altered. So we just did a general evaluation of modified boundaries, which Michelle will present. On dedicated habitat research areas, the committee recommended further development of three areas, which Michelle will go over shortly. And they also recommended that research areas sunset after 3 years if work has not been initiated. Today, there's no formal action required, but we will be welcoming any feedback on the Habitat Committee recommendations. And today we'll also be segueing into a consideration of the groundfish actions through the CAT, Close Area Technical Team. So having said that, the only thing I want to add is that In answer to a question that was brought up to me earlier, and I just want to make sure everybody understands that what we're doing with the Habitat Amendment is specified under the 1996 reauthorization of Magnuson, which was also known as the Sustainable Fisheries Act. And having said that, I'm going to turn this over to Michelle for her report.
Thank you. Good morning. This presentation is basically a companion piece to the longer document that's in your binders under tab 7 Habitat. The longer document is number 2, and it basically goes through the range of options and alternatives that are in this presentation in some greater detail and provides some additional background about how the different options were developed. But I'm happy to take questions on any more detail than is in the presentation. A number of you saw a very similar presentation to this last week at the Groundfish Committee meeting. Feels like it was more than a week ago, but in any event, I think Dave sort of covered the status update pretty well. I'll flesh a few things out and... is this too close? I'll flesh a few of those ideas out and let you know sort of what the PDT has been working on and what our plans are for the coming weeks. Dave covered this. The purpose is to sort of review where we're at in terms of committee and PDT work completed since we last reported out to the council in September of last year. specifically, there's been a few updates and discussions about habitat management areas and options, management measures that would go within those areas. And then we also have evolved from a large range of potential dedicated habitat research area proposals down to three, sort of really solid possibilities that we're going to continue to work on and flesh out and analyze. So we'd be happy to take any feedback you have on this work to guide the PDT and their work in the coming month or so. After the habitat report, obviously, as mentioned, you're going to get a report from the Groundfish Committee and the Closed Area Technical Team, or CAT. This kind of complements that, and the two, CAT and Habitat PDT and Groundfish Committee and Habitat Committee processes are going to sort of continue to intersect and overlap more and more. There's a lot of integration at the staff level, at the technical team levels, and, we're sort of trying to build on each other's work and not duplicate. I'm not sure it was clear at the committee meeting last week that there is a really high level of integration even at this stage, so that's just why I wanted to mention it to this group now.
Michelle, would you bring the mic closer? Would you bring the mic closer to you and then have a tough time?
Okay, we'll see how that goes. So as much as we're going to talk about timelines, I'm sure later, after the CAT report, which is, I think, probably the appropriate time in the day to get into this, this is more just for everyone's reference. For those of you who haven't been here since we initiated the Omnibus Amendment, which is actually a number of you at this point, just to kind of, point out sort of where we've been and the major milestones that have happened. The two things I would point out on this slide, and it bled over to the next slide because I didn't want six-point font, is that as we've developed this, we've basically added two major elements over time. We added development of a whole range of coral protection measures. The council asked us to do that in, I believe, early 2008, and that was in response to the updated reauthorization of the Magnus Act, including discretionary provisions to protect corals. So that's a whole other set of alternatives we developed as a part of this amendment, which has since been split off that wasn't sort of originally envisioned. And then the second thing that was added later on in April of 2011 was consideration of the possible modifications and evaluation of the groundfish closed areas. And that, wasn't something we started out envisioning, but I think it became clear to everyone on the plan development team and the committee that there's obviously a huge spatial overlap between those two sets of areas, which sort of drove us to ask if we could, maybe consider merging those two sets of considerations into this single amendment. So this, this action has definitely evolved and changed from what it was originally envisioned to be as we've moved along. And I was sort of trying to think, about how these two different elements, the corals and the groundfish areas, have sort of fit in with the other different things we've done as a part of this amendment. So I'm not sure whether this kind of layout is helpful for other people or not, but I just tried to kind of capture, when did we start, when did we add certain elements to the action, and, how long did we spend doing certain things? There was a long break in the middle where we were basically developing analytical tools, the SASE approach, And really, we've, sort of relatively recently added in consideration of the groundfish areas, and even more recently actually started having the ability to work on that, developing those options. So this is more for background. It may come up again later in the day, but just sort of wanted to put this out there so people can sort of think about where we're at in the whole process. So basically, in the document and the presentation, there's two different types of sort of management areas that are envisioned. The first are these what we're calling habitat management areas, or HMAs, if you see that acronym. The purpose of these areas is to meet our requirement under the Magnuson Act to minimize the adverse effects of fishing on EFH to the extent practicable. And so these are a range of areas that have been developed over really the last couple of years based on the not only the swept area seabed impact model analyses, but also some other information that didn't really fit well into the model framework. some of these areas are based on existing habitat management areas and are basically modifications and of those areas and represent kind of a focusing on the key sort of aspects of that area that we think are sort of the most vulnerable to fishing, and those would be the habitats that are dominated by lots of cobble and boulder substrate, dominant substrate areas. Some of the areas are new, and we were sort of guided to look into them further on the basis of the swept area seabed impact model results. Something I want to mention in regards to this third bullet, so most of them are, at this point, and the way it's written up in the document is that they're proposed as mobile bottom 10 gear closures, except for, Ammon Rock that was envisioned as sort of an area for enhanced protection that would be off limits to all fishing gear types the council has the ability to regulate. And this Ammon Rock area is wholly within the Cache's Ledge habitat closure, either the one that exists currently or the modification that's envisioned. And so that's sort of the way it's written up. We did consider the possibility of trawl gear modifications, as Dave mentioned, for a number of these areas. The advisory panel, primarily with some input from the PDT, recommended gear modifications for some specific areas in quite a bit of detail, and didn't make explicit recommendations for other areas. And we brought all that to the committee meeting last month, and ultimately the committee decided not to move forward with those gear modification areas at this time. But as Dave mentioned, something that that came out of the advisory panel and PDT discussions was sort of the information that we don't have that would really allow us to design those type of gear modifications and have a good sense that they would be effective and know sort of what the cost might be in terms of if you implemented a gear modification, how does that affect the catchability of the gear, that kind of thing. And there was basically a lot of information that we felt was missing at this point that would allow us to really have confidence that these that the habitat management areas gear modifications would be doing what we would hope that they would do, which is to minimize the adverse effects of fishing on EFH. And so there was a lot of discussion at the PDT and advisory panel level and at the committee level about how do we get that data. And the PDT has sort of started developing a data collection program and which elements would we need to know in order to be able to do this, these things in the future. so the point I wanted to make that was brought out to me by an audience member is that sort of another way that you could actually structure this whole options alternatives document would be that for each of the habitat management areas that are envisioned, you could essentially have two. You define the area, the boundaries of the area, based on encompassing the right types of habitats, and then you'd have either an option to close it to mobile gears, which is what's currently written up, or you'd put it in this sort of data collection track, and then you'd consider whether or not gear modifications might be appropriate in the future. There is mention in this document of the idea of making those gear modifications frameworkable within habitat management areas that you've already defined via an amendment. So the exact sort of structure of how this document is laid out might not be precisely what, you know, the committee's vision was. So I'm happy to take comments on that from committee members or from others. but in any case, I think, you know, the objective broadly is to figure out a way that we can get more information and then maybe use these kinds of gear changes in the future rather than needing to have closures to certain gear types. So, and then the next kind of steps here, you know, these areas are developed based on habitat objectives, with the objective, broadly speaking, being to encompass areas that are dominated by lots of complex habitats, cobble and boulder substrates, and the sort of structural biota that are associated with those substrate types. As we move forward, as the CAT gets further along with its work and makes specific area recommendations to the groundfish committee, we're going to have to think about how the two sets of areas overlap and complement one another, and the boundaries of these areas may make sense to be modified depending on how they're adjacent to or close by to different groundfish areas. So here's just an overview of the various different areas. You can probably read this and see this a version of this a little bit better in the document. But essentially you can see that there's basically some of the areas, Jeffrey's Bank, Cash's Ledge, the Jeffrey's Ledge and Stellwagen areas really build upon management areas that we already have. Fippany's Ledge is kind of in between. It's within an existing groundfish closure, but is an area that hasn't previously been singled out for habitat protection. And then we've got some areas that we think have habitats that are vulnerable to fishing and important to protect in some way and minimize the effects of fishing on that are not currently managed for habitat purposes. And so that would be areas like Platts Bank, George's Shoal west of Closed Area 2, these areas sort of between the Cape and the deepest parts of the channel, and these areas down on Cox Ledge. And for many of these locations, there's multiple areas proposed, and at least what the committee is envisioning, I think, at this point, is that we would sort of present and analyze each of the sub-areas individually and that they might be implemented in combination, so say both the areas on Platts Bank, or you might choose one or the other. And so I think that's true across all the areas. Once we get to the slide with the channel areas, I'll explain some of the modifications that we're looking into there. So obviously, as part of this amendment, we're going to analyze the status quo habitat management areas. And essentially, there's sort of two categories of areas where are options for these areas that the committee has discussed and that are laid out in the longer document. There are areas that are envisioned as not being completely removed but only modified, and so that would be Jeffrey's Bank and Cash's Ledge. So there's options to keep the areas as they appear here or to modify them, and the Jeffrey's Bank modification I'll get to and the Cash's in a few slides. Whereas there are some other areas that are envisioned for possibly completely removing, and so those would be the other areas that are identified. The Western Gulf of Maine, Closed Area 2, Closed Area 1, and the lightship habitat areas. So Jeffrey's Bank isn't within a groundfish closure. It was added as a separate habitat management area via Amendment 13. So we've discussed a couple of different modifications. But sort of Jeffrey's Bank is multiple kind of shallow features, and it's on the tops of these shallower features where you find the complex habitat types. And so the PDT basically discussed and developed a boundary that encompasses really the shallower features in this region. And we have, some visual video sampling data that indicates sort of the distribution of those habitats. The existing area here is what's hatched, and if the area is changed, this area would be reopened and sort of the boundaries would be extended on these sides. We have gotten some industry feedback from folks that are fishing in this region about what the possible implications of these changes might be. Apparently there's quite a bit of fixed gear that actually is used within this northern part here, and so there could be some issues there if this change is made. So we're going to continue to look into those, and obviously as we analyze these, we're going to be looking at fishing distributions, fish distributions, and habitat value within all of the range of areas. There's a number of things going on sort of in the region of Cash's Ledge. As you're all familiar, this is it's a regular shape as the existing groundfish closure. And there's basically two shallow features within this closure. There's Fippany's Ledge out here to the west, and then Cash's Ledge, which kind of runs northwest to southeast. And the existing closure is a little bit larger, and based on some actually industry suggestions at a PDT meeting quite a while back. The idea was that, you know, if access were allowed into this groundfish closure, there may be some fishing opportunities sort of along the margin of the ledge here in deeper water. And the focus in terms of protecting complex bottom types and the associated features on those, which interestingly for Cache's ledge and somewhat uniquely offshore includes a lot of kelp and algal habitats. Those are really more within this sort of shallower part of the ledge itself. And then this yellow area here is the very pinnacle of the ledge, the shallowest part, and that's what's considered Amun Rock. And so that's what's envisioned as that sort of enhanced protection area that would be off limits from algiers. So that's currently what's being discussed in this region. Here's a Platts Bank. Originally, this area is currently open to various types of fishing. Where we originally started with this area was similar to Jeffrey's Bank, a boundary that encompassed everything shallower than about 100 meters, which is where you're most likely to find complex habitat types. And we essentially focused down to sort of the two shallowest parts that, you know, based on the mapping data, habitat mapping data that we do have, are containing the preponderance of the cobble and boulder substrates on the top of the bank. And this area is proposed as a mobile bottom 10-acre closure or has been envisioned as part of this possible data collection program as an alternative to that. In the Western Gulf of Maine, there's actually sort of a number of options for this area in the document, but what we have currently is the entire, most of the Western Gulf of Maine groundfish management area is a habitat closure, except for this very eastern part that was approved as a possible sector exemption area by the council last month. And so within this larger habitat closure, you've got two major features. You've got Stellwagen Bank, at least parts of it, and you've got Jeffrey's Ledge. And Jeffrey's Ledge also, the feature kind of extends out down towards Cape Ann. And essentially what evolved out of the plan development team and committee process was a honing in on the shallowest, most complex areas. And on Jeffrey's Ledge, we did that based on the substrate data that went into the SASE model. And also we've got, since we developed the model, there was additional similarly collected video sampling data a couple years ago that gives us a much better picture of sediment type distributions on parts of the ledge. And then in Stellwagen, this area was actually designed based on sort of extra SASE, if you will, information. This area has been well mapped with multi-beam, and so we have a good sense for the distribution of the boulder ridges that occur throughout this region and also outside of the management area. And so the extent of this purple area basically, the eastern extent goes to the limit of that multi-beam coverage. We know that those habitat types probably go beyond that to the east, but this is where the sort of understanding of the distribution of vulnerable habitats is the inference is the easiest to make. So again, these areas are envisioned at this time as mobile bottom 10-acre closures, but could certainly fit in with the data collection for potentially future gear modifications sort of set up as well. I'll get to it later, but this purple outline here is the dedicated habitat research area proposal that's in this region, and it overlaps both of the envisioned habitat management areas. So getting to George's Bank, up on the northeastern part of the bank, we've got a few different areas that this committee is considering. Obviously, the existing habitat management area is here. This is also a habitat area of particular concern, and it has been for a number of years. These other areas to the west, George's Shoal itself is actually kind of over here. So this location and then the George's Shoal East location were designed to be outside of the existing closure but encompass areas where there's high concentrations of particularly cobble and also in some cases boulder, but mainly cobble habitats in this location. Essentially, the northern edge of Georges Bank has these sort of long glacially deposited gravel, gravel being small granules, pebbles, and cobbles with some boulder ridge areas interspersed with sort of sand ridges. And so these two areas get at some of those cobble gravel habitats. Moving west on Georges Bank, we've got a number of areas identified that would protect similar types of complex habitat, including cobble boulder habitats sort of off the Cape and between the Lightship and Closed Area 1. And these are the areas that were discussed as it would make sense to just develop a single area for these. And I can bring up sort of the potential options if we like later. I didn't put them on here because the committee hasn't actually had the opportunity to discuss them yet in any detail. But essentially, the existing areas are based on the distribution of dominant substrate in this region. And some specific feedback that we've gotten about these four areas, this northeastern corner of this first area, which is alternately called Great South Channel 1 or Chatham Light, is a bit deeper, sort of sandier habitat. And so it was requested that we maybe look at just removing this corner if these four areas are what goes forward. And you know, the PDT had discussed that and sees no reason why that's in any way inconsistent with how these areas were designed in the first place. So that's something that the committee can discuss again, but the PDT's feedback is that that seems like a reasonable idea from a habitat management perspective. And the other thing that's been done is sort of looking at the greater Great South Channel sort of region, if you will, and trying to figure out, well, what's the proportion of that area that has boulder and cobble substrates, and how much of those complex substrate areas could you encompass with a single management area? And so the PDT has developed basically three options that all do a similar job with it covering a similar amount of area in terms of square miles, and then also covering a similar proportion of the Great South Channel's region boulder and cobble substrates. Another option was put forward by the Fisheries Survival Fund, which we analyzed, that is slightly larger in size and gets at similar protection for boulder and cobble areas. So we'll bring this all to the committee when they meet next. But I think, you know, there's a lot of sort of good options in the works that can accomplish what I think the committee's objective was, which was to design a single area, which would be, I think, simpler from, you know, a use and enforcement perspective that basically encompasses areas of similar habitat protection value to these four boundaries. And I think that's eminently doable, and we're working on it. So finally, furthest to the south, the Cox Ledge areas, these were also kind of emerged from the swept area seabed impact model analyses and clustering work of highly vulnerable areas, and these have sort of similar habitat characteristics, and they're also proposed as either gear closures, or they could, again, fit into that sort of data collection thinking to the future towards gear modifications type of framework. I think I probably actually covered all this earlier. I maybe should have put the slide further up in the presentation. But the committee reviewed all the gear modification work done by the advisory panel and plan development team. And those two groups developed specific measures for Georges Shoal and the Great South Channel areas. And the committee reviewed those but didn't forward any on. But they did ask the PDT to flesh out a data collection program that would basically allow the council to or give the council the information they needed to be able to design these type of measures in the future. And the intent, as David mentioned, was to be able to define a habitat management area in this action and potentially not put measures in it right now or put mobile gear closure measures in it right now and then change that area later to a gear modification area if, you know, that's supported by the data that would be collected under this program. So something else that, you know, we've discussed kind of as we've gone along here is that, you know, looking at the chart with all the various areas, including the existing areas and all the potential new areas or modified areas, you have a really pretty complex a la carte menu. and it would be challenging to analyze and explain sort of the cumulative impacts, and also a little bit harder, I think, for people to understand what's likely to be implemented. And so what the PDT has recommended is combining these areas into alternatives. Ultimately, you know, we envision that happening after we have groundfish management areas on the table, and then we sort of have single sets of area management alternatives that meet both habitat and groundfish objectives. But what's been currently discussed by the committee, this wasn't actually discussed in any detail at the last meeting, but really at the prior meeting, was one way that you could conceive of packaging them was to go with either a no-action option or an alternative that makes all the changes. And so you remove areas that are on the table for removal, you'd modify areas that are under consideration for modification, and then you'd add the new areas. And then sort of once we get further along in the process of gathering public comments, have public hearings, then you might design a third alternative that would be analyzed for the final version of the EIS that would be a subset of the everything new or modified alternative. So the committee may sort of take this up again, may end up with a slightly different recommendation once we see what the groundfish management options are. But this is kind of the committee's current line of thinking as of last fall. So where are we going next with this? Obviously, we're going to continue to develop potential modifications for the Great South Channel area and bring those to the committee, and also try and analyze the areas with respect to fish distributions, in which the work and the data that the CAT is assembling is going to be hugely helpful to the habitat PDT. Look at sort of fishing distributions within these areas as kind of a overlapping between both the PDT and CAT processes. We're developing revenue and fishing distribution data sets that will be used by both teams, and so we can look at that, and also trying to characterize the habitat values in the areas using information from the SASE model, using other information we've considered as a part of the process, review the literature. And so hopefully we can start to assemble that, and for the next time that the council sees these, we'll have those analyses, at least, you know, on an individual area basis, not some kind of a cumulative effects basis, but we'll have information like that to bring to the council. obviously, the CAT is continuing to work, and Andy will talk about that in a little while, so I'm not going to steal his thunder, but once you know, those recommendations go through the process, then we'll think about how they overlap with the habitat management areas. Obviously, from a technical standpoint, we're going to kind of continue to do that as we go along, because the CAT is aware of these habitat management areas, and, you know, I'm aware of what the CAT is working on. But there'll be sort of a more formal process between the committees to think about how these areas might overlap. And I guess the other thing would be to, you know, keep developing any data collection towards future gear modifications and think about how that sort of fits into the structure of the alternatives and the options in the document. So next we have this second category of habitat areas, and those would be dedicated habitat research areas. And basically the PDT has spent sort of the last year thinking about this. And we started with a research agenda, which was born a lot out of the work we did with the SASE model and thinking about, well, what do we still not know or do we not have as good an understanding of as we would like to. You know, there's still things we don't understand about gear impacts, particularly related to non-mobile gears. Almost all the gear impacts literature is focused on mobile gear impacts, especially trawl gear impacts. And we know very little about how fixed gears impact the seabed, how much area they actually are contacting, what their footprint is, that kind of thing. And there haven't been a lot of opportunities to do really well-controlled before-after control impact studies either. So a lot of the sort of gear impacts research has, you know, assumed, you know, some level of disturbance that's related to fisheries, but, you know, the level of disturbance is pretty imprecise because it's not being the disturbance isn't happening at the research level. It's just sort of the background of what the fisheries are doing. So there's a lot more that you could learn. Something else that is sort of less well understood in the literature than we would like are habitat recovery rates. In some cases, that's just because these studies aren't conducted for long enough, or because it seems that some of these habitats actually take a really long time to recover, and we're not sure that we've seen an endpoint anywhere. An example of the work that's been done in this regard is in the Western Gulf of Maine. There's been monitoring sort of for years to look at the cobble habitats in the area of the Stellwagen Bank National Marine Sanctuary that overlaps the Western Gulf of Maine closure, and we're still seeing apparently change in those areas. Getting a better sense for how in higher energy areas, so particularly the areas like Georges Bank, how do natural disturbances versus human-induced disturbances sort of stack up to affect and impact seabed habitats. And finally, sort of the holy grail of habitat research that we don't know a lot about, and everyone wishes we did, was, well, how do habitats that are, sort of in a specific state of health, which I guess is a crummy word to use, but, how do those habitats in specific locations contribute to the productivity of managed resources? Via the omnibus amendment, any protections that are implemented, we're, sort of going to be making some inferences about that and trying to understand, what do we know about codfish associations with complex habitat at different times in their life? Are there codfish here, the right habitat types here, and making an inference that protecting those areas is going to help codfish? But there's, still a lot that we could stand to learn about, exactly how different fish respond to habitat protections. So that's sort of a primary objective that would be work that would be conducted, I hope, in any of these research areas. So probably these research areas, I think what we've envisioned is that they would be designated under a separate set of regulations, even if their boundaries were the same as some of these habitat management areas that you saw earlier, which is looking like they probably won't be, but that you'd sort of have a complementary set of regulations that would relate to the research area. And a big reason for doing that was because the committee discussed that research areas, should be a temporary if they're not going to be used or, only sort of in place while they're being continuously used for research. And so we've sort of discussed, what the council would need to specify via this omnibus amendment in order to allow, say, the Fisheries Service to evaluate, is this area being used? And we'd set up a number of criteria here in the omnibus, and then that evaluation would be made, and the areas could sunset if they're not being used for research within the time frame envisioned by the council. and it wouldn't require the council to go through and do a whole amendment to remove them. And so we think that probably will work. And so that's sort of one reason for implementing them under a different set of regulations. Something else that we really haven't discussed a whole lot for these research areas is what sorts of activities would need to be off limits within the areas in order for you to be able to conduct your research and have fishing or other types of activities not impacting the research. And so presumably it might be closure to certain gears, mobile gears, maybe fixed bottom tending gears or other gears that remove species that you're interested in looking at. So that, for these individual areas, needs to sort of be further fleshed out, but that's something we're going to need to consider as we develop these alternatives further. As we designed these areas, they were sort of intended to complement and build on the range of habitat management area designations that were developed. And so, in some cases, in the Sierra 2 area in particular, that area was designed to be within existing habitat management areas and overlapping with the proposed future habitat management areas. And so that's why that area doesn't actually go outside, even though the bank, Stellwagen Bank itself and the Stellwagen Bank Sanctuary actually extend further outside the existing closure to the west. So I guess I could have said that while you were looking at the chart, but I think the copy you have actually doesn't have the sanctuary boundary on it, but I wanted to include it just because I figured it might come up in discussion. And so, again, here are the areas that discussed earlier. The southern part of this Jeffrey's Ledge area, the Stellwagen habitat management area, which really gets at the cobble and boulder habitats within the Western Gulf of Maine closure. And then the sanctuary is sort of lightly shaded, overlapping. And the Sierra 2, or the Sanctuary Ecological Research Area 2, which followed from just a Sierra proposal, which is hence the 2, which some of you may have seen or remember. I'm not sure it was ever presented to the council, but it was presented to the committee. And it did go outside of the Western Gulf of Maine closure boundaries. But that area is here. And the thing that Sierra 2 does that this Stellwagen area doesn't do is it encompasses some deeper water mud habitats that are basically between Jeffrey's Ledge and Stellwagen Bank. we don't think that those are the most vulnerable habitat types from a adverse effects minimization perspective, but there's certainly a lot of interesting questions to be asked about how different fish species are associated with those areas. There's been ongoing research stations in these areas to understand their ecology and sort of recovery from different types of impact and that kind of thing. And so this Tier 2 area is envisioned as a broader research area. it obviously has a nexus to the Stellwagen Bank National Marine Sanctuary. But the actual area boundaries and the proposal sort of came from a beyond the sanctuary process. The sanctuary has its own advisory council, which the council sits on as a ex officio member, and I attend their meetings. But some of the sort of folks that are involved either directly or sort of follow that process came up with these area boundaries. And so at least from some segments of the commercial fishing industry, there's sort of buy-in for this possible research area boundary. And so it's, you know, we're going to continue to evaluate the habitat values it encompasses and the kinds of questions you could answer. And we've gotten a lot of help from the sanctuary itself in terms of discussing and fleshing out some of those ideas. Something that is going to have to happen in these research areas is a level of coordination and oversight that really I think either the sanctuary itself or the Northeast Regional Office have the capacity to provide. And that would include things like issuing letters of acknowledgement to folks that are doing research in these areas, or even letters of authorization if people are doing, say, mobile gear impacts research that conflicts with habitat management area designation or something like that. And so for this location, it's envisioned that would be sort of a coordinated effort between the regional office and the sanctuary staff. And we're not sure exactly how that would play out yet, but I think a particular strength of this area is the sort of capacity of Stellwagen Sanctuary that's already sort of built in. And so as we further develop it, we're going to really clarify how the research agenda lines up with different attributes of this area, species that are here, what we already know and still remains to be learned. It also sort of dovetails with the sanctuary's own objectives and management plan, and so we'll figure out sort of how those two things overlap. And then sort of flesh out what restrictions or anything might be necessary in this area and continue to move forward with developing, well, how do we know if an area is being used and, you know, how would the sort of sunsetting aspects work administratively? And so that's all stuff that we're continuing to work on. A research area that was sort of more recently brought into the process was this Eastern Maine dedicated habitat research area. and what you see on the figure isn't a proposed boundary of the area. It's really the boundaries of the cluster of vulnerable habitat grid cells that came out of the swept area seabed impact model. These all have a really kind of odd shape because the domain of the model stops at state waters. And so there's sort of state waters over here, and then obviously northwest of these areas. So something that the plan development team is currently working on is figuring out sort of how far there's lots of sort of boulder ridge habitat. I mean, obviously, if you look at the islands off the coast of Maine, these more or less kind of extend underwater. And so there's a lot of complex features in here. And so we're trying to figure out what data sources are available to help us bound a research area that encompasses the habitat types that would be of interest to do some work in without sort of going too far offshore into areas where there's a lot of fishing activity occurring. So we know that this right off the coast here, there's lots of complex structural habitat. We've also, in the context of a range of coral protection alternatives, looked at an area that's essentially just southwest of Mount Desert Rock, which has a lot of corals in that area. We expect that those types of habitats that have been seen visually in coral surveys with ROVs probably extend to other areas on the coast of Maine, but we just don't have them well documented. So sort of where the plan development team is at with this proposal is trying to figure out what appropriate boundaries might be within federal waters based on habitat data that we have or that we can obtain. And then trying to figure out, you know, what species are here, how do they use these habitats, what questions should we really be asking for these areas. And we'll bring sort of that updated information to the committee next time that they meet in potentially about a month or so. And then finally, there's a third research area that has been discussed on Georges Bank, and this is the southern part of the existing Closed Area 1 habitat closure, and this has been envisioned as an area where you would try and understand specifically the links between scallop abundance and distribution and recruitment, either through studies of the natural populations or potentially seeding type of experiments, and that you would that this would be a great site in order to do that type of work. And so, you know, whether this is the boundary that really makes sense for this or something slightly different or is something we're going to continue to explore. But this is a proposal, again, that the theme, I guess, with these research areas that have kind of come through the committee process is that they're all somewhat stakeholder-driven from, you know, one or the other sort of arm of the industry. Or in the case of the Stellwagen industry, in addition to the sanctuary itself and their interested parties. But, you know, this was a stakeholder scallop industry-driven proposal to have an area to ask these types of scallop productivity questions. And so we're going to continue, again, to flesh out goals and objectives and, you know, specifically what would we be trying to get out of this research area here. Okay. So that's all I have. I'm happy to take questions, or if Dave wants to make some additional comments.
Dave.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. There are just a couple of things that I wanted to expand on and emphasize. So would you go to slide number 7, Michelle? Yeah, I'm bringing my computer seems to be slow this morning, or else I am. Okay, there were only a couple of things I want to point out, and these are in response to things that I've been asked about more or less repeatedly. After the 96 Sustainable Fisheries Act, the original habitat closures, in 96 when we were directed to protect habitat, nobody really knew how, not anywhere. So this has been a learning process, just as fisheries management in general was from 1976 on. And at the beginning, habitat closures were, since nobody knew where to put them, they just put them on top of the same closures that were already or were being put in place for groundfish. So if we look at this, I'd like to direct your attention to the Nantucket Lightship closed area as an example of the kind of thing that we have to deal with. The groundfish closure is the large rectangular area bounded by the purple dashes. And then in the middle of it and going up, you see the habitat closure. What we decided, we discovered, and this is for the benefit of quite a number of people who weren't here at the time, what we discovered right at the get-go was that if we were going to reorient the habitat closed areas to more appropriate areas, it would involve opening up a lot of areas that never should have been closed in the first place, as well as closing a few new areas, less actually in extent than we had before. But if you are a ground fisherman or any fisherman looking at this, if we had done that without consideration of the ground fish areas, what they would actually have seen wasn't that we were protecting less habitat area, but that we were taking up more real estate. And it was realized 2 years ago that that was politically non-viable and should have been, as well as being unfair, profoundly unfair to the industry. So that was why the decision was made. Actually, it was made in April of 2011 to do the ground fish closures, to review the ground fish closures for changes that would be compatible with the more modern thinking. That's why it was put together in April of 2011. I just wanted I've been asked by a number of the new, particularly newer members, about why do we have them linked? Why can't we just like separate them and move on with one or the other? That was the actual reason, and I just wanted to make that plain. Secondly, I have one other point. The protection of habitat involves protecting the substrate in the same way that farmers have to protect their soil. And the substrate is not just simply gravel or sand, and there's been that misconception that somehow that if we just protect the gravel areas, we'll be doing the right job. The problem is that the benthic habitat is only one-third made up of the geological structures. Two-thirds of it is biological. It's just as with soil, you've got about a third of the soil is made up of the underlying broken-down rock, and about two-thirds of it is all the microbes and organic matter and the small invertebrates that live in the soil. It's exactly the same thing with the bottom. So that's why this became more complicated as time went on. And the dedicated habitat research areas that we've got in place are needed to improve the science, the understanding of that, because we really are nowhere near where the farmers, for instance, and the agricultural colleges are with their understanding of that substrate. We're in sort of that same position, but decades behind them. So we need to improve in ground truth SASE. That's one of the reasons for it. Now, what we have to do is balance the actual needs for the resource versus what Terry one time said, well, let's not go too far because we're creating playgrounds for scientists. So we need to balance that actual need with the creation of playgrounds for scientists. And what all of this amounts to is a basic change in how we manage the resource itself, and we need that. And I think yesterday was a prime example of that. Yesterday we heard repeatedly that we need to change how we manage and that we need to improve the science. That's what's being done here, and changing the management has got to respect the fact that there are things about the ecosystem that we just simply don't know. And we've done things to the ecosystem without even knowing what we've done. So that's the underlying reason behind all of this. And I can tell you personally, I don't ever want to go through what we did yesterday. That was awful, and everybody knows it. And the way to get out of it is not to keep doing what we've done in the past. We've got to improve our understanding of how these things work. And that's basically what this is geared to it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Michelle, thank you for the presentation. I've got a list going here, but I'm going to jump in first. Slide 17 and the comments that you made lead me to believe that there has been, because of the frustration of the current pace of how things are moving along, there has been some ongoing discussion about looking at separating things out again. But it seems to me, from what you're saying, you're at a point where you're waiting for the groundfish stuff to catch up to you, and that it doesn't make any sense to separate the two because the alternatives will be created by the actual melding of the two together. Did I hear you correctly on that?
Yeah, I think that's accurate. And then the other thing, well, yeah, and even if, say, that there's no additional or new groundfish management areas recommended, part of the mix here is still, you know, the existing ground fish areas and how these interact with any of the possible new habitat management areas. And the other point I think that's worth making is that we're going to need to evaluate the effects of existing and proposed modified or new habitat management areas on ground fish resources. And that's a not insubstantial task that's going to take, you know, quite a lot of work. So it's not like by sort of separating the ground fish elements out of the omnibus amendment that we avoid the need to look at ground fish related production and questions like that, protection with regards to these areas. So I think regardless of sort of how we move forward in terms of the scope of the omnibus amendment, there's quite a lot of analytical overlap that's going to have to happen anyway as part of our development of an EIS. So.
Thank you. I have John Bullard, then Terry Stockwell.
Thanks, Michelle and Dave. This is important work, and I have two questions, both relating to scalloping. On the slide relating to west of Great South Channel, if you would elaborate, I know I got a lot of comment from Cape scallopers, small boat scallopers, on the impact they felt we were, and you mentioned this, that they felt that these four areas were essentially going to shut off all the places that they have to go. Could you again say what you think you're going to do, or Dave, are you going to answer this? What you think you're going to do so that they still have places to go chase scallops?
We have a proposal that wasn't included here because it's not fully developed yet.
Yeah.
It's going to alter the and we're working with the scallop people on this. The primary problem that they had was the Great South Channel Area 1 on the slide. And up in the northeast corner, there's area there that really we don't need and for habitat, and that they do need for what they're doing. So we are in the process now of making changes here. And that is in the, I guess you'd call it the negotiation phase right now.
Okay.
Those people were at our last committee meeting. We had an extended discussion on just that point. And I made very strongly the point to those people that we aren't in business here to put them out of business.
Okay.
And it was I'll just say it flat out, it was an oversight.
Okay.
And we will fix that.
Okay. The second question I have may not be best answered by your committee. I'm not sure, given what Rip just said. But that is the offshore scallop fleet has said in the past how important it is in the very northern part of closed area 2 to gain access very quickly to a bed of scallops that is a very clean bed of scallops, no yellowtail flounder, and how their access to this is dependent on this amendment. And so I'm interested in the schedule. And so can you enlighten me as to how this work, and I guess it also relates to what Rip was just talking about. What do we foresee as when they're going to be able to do that, given the schedule here?
Well, Michelle is going to be putting the timeline up, I think, right after Andy's presentation. Yeah.
Okay. I can wait that long.
Yeah. There isn't any question in our minds but that the scallop industry, and they've been involved with this from the get-go, they really do need another rotational closed area up in that region. These closed areas are in an evolution right now that includes them as part of the negotiation. And what you see here on slide slide 13 is a general representation of where we are now. We expect that there will be some minor alterations to that, but the whole thing will be laid before the council in April. And in April is our plan. As far as what Rip mentioned before, deciding whether to keep the two parts together or separated is a strictly as you understand, a cost-benefit analysis. That's what it is. Rip and I have been talking extensively about just exactly that thing. And the question is, how soon can we get it open? And at this point, we don't see any difference in practical terms on an opening date by doing it, splitting everything apart and then having to deal with those problems, or at this point, at any rate, keeping them together. But I think we need to see what Andy has in order to make that decision clearly.
Terry Stockwell.
Yeah, thank you for the presentation, Michelle. At one point, the Habitat Committee had an area of Cash's Ledge under consideration for a dedicated habitat research area. Has that fallen off the table?
I think it has. The PDT came up with a number of different options that would either do just a control impact design or actual before after control impact design in the region of Cash's Ledge, and we ran that by the committee in December, and that wasn't moved forward for further consideration. So unless anyone on the committee disagrees, that's sort of the understanding I'm moving forward with.
So for my clarification then, it would, the three areas that the committee is currently considering are the three that you just presented. Thank you.
Terry Alexander.
Yeah, Michelle, refresh my memory. Why didn't we consider the GIA modifications that the advisor panel gave us at the Habitat Committee meeting? I couldn't remember.
You mean why? I mean that they were discussed and considered. Why did the committee not opt to move forward with any of those? I think it's basically because we, you know, the PDT had raised a number of concerns about that we simply don't have the information to know how effectively those types of measures would work to protect habitat. We know that the measures, for everybody's sort of clarification, and you got the report from that October advisory panel meeting the last time with the last council meeting's documents, but basically the options were limiting, putting a length cap on ground cables, and then raising those ground cables off the seabed with sort of spaced rollers, and sort of so you'd be able to estimate, well, how much less width does the gear have? But the thing that we really wouldn't know is, how does that affect catchability, and do you simply need to fish more for longer toes to catch the same numbers of fish? And so given sort of that major question, it wasn't clear to the PDT that you'd be able to achieve actual benefits to habitat, reductions in habitat impacts with gear modifications, just given what we currently know. And I think that that's what the committee was sort of responding to when they decided not to move those options forward.
Okay. So I, now that you said that, it reminded me that we had talked what we had said. But we also talked about putting some kind of protocol in for the observers to figure out exactly what people were towing in that area. And I've done some talking to Tor Bendixson and stuff about that, and they actually have a form. Tor actually has a form that tells you that an observer could go to the skipper and say, okay, put down what you're towing for gear and everything. And actually NOAA has a form that they use on all their ships that, I mean, we have fast access to that. And I guess we need to, maybe it's a long-term plan, but, I mean, we probably need to implement that as an observer protocol, and then see how that goes for a year, and then maybe kick in those gear modifications and see that, you know, to have some kind of comparison, because there's no way to. And I think the advisors were being proactive and trying to figure out a way to lessen the impact on the seafloor, because, I mean, a lot of our blackback, Georges Bank blackback quota comes out of the shoals, and probably 80% of the blackbacks on Georges come out of there. And that's going to be a stock that we're going to need access to. I guess that's all I have for now.
Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, thank you, Michelle. That's a very comprehensive presentation. Makes things a lot clearer for me as to where the committee and the plan development team is now with their progress. John Bullard highlighted one of my points, which is the west of the Great South Channel area, and I'm glad to see the scholars are working with the plan development team and the committee to deal with the areas designated as 1 and 2, Great South Channel 1 and Great South Channel 2. I've been told by the general category of fishermen, many of them, that almost the entire fleet from the Chatham area or nearby ports, they get 95% of all of the scallops from those two areas. So I'm glad to see they're working with you. But relative to those areas, I noticed in your presentation that you said that the objective, so far the committee objective, and maybe the council has already signed off on this, I can't recall how far we've taken it, the objective is to design a single area, this is on page 7 in the presentation, the objective is to design a single area that has similar habitat protection value to the four areas. So my question is, what is the habitat protection value of the four areas that we see before us now? In other words, are we covering 50% of all of the habitat that is considered to be sensitive and vulnerable? Is it 25% or 75%?
Let me see if I can pull that up. I think sort of the way that the the PDT conceived of doing this was figuring out what's the whole channel region look like. I'll bring this up. Oh God, that's huge. Okay, so sort of what are we considering the channel region, and what coverage of complex substrates are in that region, and then what proportion of that is encompassed by the existing areas. And so, let's see. So the whole region has is about 3,200 square miles, and the portion of the region that is covered by granule or pebble, which includes some really small gravels and larger as well, is about 800 square miles, so maybe a quarter, if my math is right. And then in total, there's about 321 square miles that are covered with either boulder or cobble-dominated habitat types. So what the PDT came up with were sort of three additional proposals that either that do 50% roughly of the cobble boulder habitat in that greater region, and about 20 to 30% of the granule pebble habitat. The scale of this, the area is really dominated by sand, and this should go, you know, way off to the side somewhere. So we're looking at the current range of areas that are you saw in the presentation are about half of the cobble boulder habitat, and the 43%. And then, you know, these different proposals perform similarly in terms of that. And then this project two is actually the Survival Fund proposal that we looked at that gets at about 40% of the boulder cobble habitat. And it's really further sort of to the south and the west and avoids, in particular, those two, 1 and 2 boxes that are furthest to the north, which are, and then I think the other box further to the east is a little bit more important for the limited access end of the scallop fishery.
Okay, so you've been given guidance by the committee as to how much of this different type, bottom type, should be protected. And now you're looking at some other boundaries.
within that general region that would provide the same amount of protection of habitat and cobble and granule. Okay, I've got you. Thank you. All right, so as it stands right now, I think you said that, maybe David said this, that there is not going to be in this this initiative any specific gear modification strategies, that would be something to be frameworked in. Okay. That suggests to me then that, just to make sure I'm clear on this, there will be nothing proposed in this document that will suggest, for example, that scallop dredges of some size, smaller dredge size, would be permissible. That if there is a smaller dredge size that would be permissible in some of these areas, that would come about through framework action. Is that where we stand right now with the scallop gear, large gear versus small gear?
I guess, yeah, I should have mentioned this earlier, that the one sort of gear modification motion that came out of the committee in terms of tasking for the PDT was to think about whether there are scallop dredge gear modifications that might be appropriate specific to this Great South Channel region. That's not an issue that there's been a lot of work done on, to my understanding. There's been a lot of work on modifying scallop dredges for bycatch minimization of turtles and fish, but not a lot that I'm aware of in terms of modifying the environmental sort of effects of scallop dredges. So that's something that the PDT is still thinking about, and you know, if we can develop anything that might, you know, make sense for this area in terms of continuing to allow scallop access but requiring a specific gear modification, then we'll bring that forward. I don't know how far that work is going to go, but that's sort of still a pending task out there for the committee, from the committee, but it was basically specific to just this Great South Channel region and scallop dredges.
Okay, so it's pending, and it's possible then that we might actually have something from the plan development team that would involve some modification of scallop dredges to allow them access to some of these areas, potentially.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, given the amount of the work that seems to have been done on this, which I couldn't find much having looked so far, probably the more promising avenue is to figure out how to design a management area that has less impacts on those existing fishing activities, but we're looking at both.
Okay, and finally, in the Georges Bank dedicated habitat research area, you indicated in your figure that the bottom part, very bottom part of closed area one, is likely to be proposed as an area for dedicated habitat research. I'm just looking for a clarification now. That particular area is being offered up to the committee and then eventually to the full council as an area that's come out of some particular stakeholder group, and the plan development team and the committee is waiting, as it says here, for further development for goals and objectives specific to that area. So that's really, as far as I can tell, this particular suggestion is still very much a draft, because you haven't yet, the plan development team has not yet provided to the committee the specific goals and objectives, what's going to happen within that area, what's going to be achieved if that area is closed down for research. So do you expect that we will have all of that information in time for us, the committee, the council, to decide whether or not that merits being called a DHRA?
Yes, certainly. We'll have that all that information by the time that the council selects alternatives, and hopefully before the next committee meeting. I think it's a matter of sort of the PDT or parts of the PDT sitting down with the folks that are interested in doing this type of work in this area and understanding what do we need to do to design and implement a research area that meets some of their objectives, what additional objectives might make sense. And we do have a pretty detailed general list of goals and objectives, and it's really just a matter of tailoring that to the habitat types and the species that occur here, which certainly includes scallops, and there may be other issues of interest. And so, yeah, I'm envisioning doing that work in the relatively short term and being able to bring a more fleshed-out proposal to the committee next time they meet, and which could include, you know, some modification of this area boundaries. It's more of kind of a straw man at this point, but...
Dave, probably you had a comment on
yeah,
that?
Yeah, I did, in fact. In regard to Dr. Pierce's first question, it also bears on what John Bullitt asked before. The Great South Channel, the western side of the Great South Channel, the final proposals aren't going to look like what's on slide 14. Michelle and her people have done a really superb job of putting together set. Well, she had listed up there four new areas. The small boat scallop people came to us at our last committee meeting, and in the time since then, we've got a complete set of proposals available ready to go, which I didn't refer to because it hasn't been put before the committee yet. And that'll be item number one at our next committee meeting, and we're certainly going to make these changes that are going to be appropriate to preserving that part of industry. It's the right thing to do anyway. So,
Tom Dempsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thanks for those comments, Dave, and for the discussion about the Great South Channel area. It's obviously of primary importance to fishermen on Cape Cod. One of the questions that I have, though, as we look at how these boxes are being driven and what factors are going into their creation, it seems, and I think, Michelle, you said it, that these boxes are being drawn around dominant substrate types and not driven by, at least in my mind, the clustering charts that we've looked at, I think, for the better part of a number of years in the SASE analysis that took 6 years to develop. So Dr. Pierce started to get to this question, which is, how do we define habitat value, and how do we sort of make sure that we're comparing apples to apples, and what's the metric? I thought that our process of developing that SASE tool was to allow us to see these clusters that would light up that we would then build alternatives around, and in some cases, actually in most cases, it looks like throughout New England, that's what we've done. But in the Great South Channel, and arguably maybe in other spots, we've actually gone back through the sausage grinder and seem to be drawing boxes or crafting alternatives around primary substrate types, which is a crucial but single element that goes into SASE, as I understand it. So where are we with that? Even, you know, I've looked at the new proposals, and I absolutely appreciate the committee's work on crafting those. I think one box in the channel makes a lot more sense. But it seems as though there's still some discrepancy or confusion about how we're defining habitat value. And it seems more focused on a single data layer. And in my mind, if we were going to go down that path and simply draw these alternatives around dominant substrate types, we could have been done with this years ago, prior to the peer review of SASE, prior to a number of other things. So, could you talk a little bit about where the PDT is in that and how we're explaining or how we're defining habitat value and equivalency? Because it seems different in different regions, and it seems to be impacting the alternatives in the Great South Channel.
Dave, do you want to answer that?
Yeah. The single data layer point that you made is an apt point. We have to work with what we have. And as I've been stressing right along, SASE is an excellent tool, but it's not a complete tool. It's still inchoate. It still has a lot that needs to be improved because we don't have the depth of data that we would like to have. So layer onto that the fact that we also have to take into account, as we were talking about before, the cost-benefit aspect of it. So SASE becomes a prime driver, but not the prime driver. And these become value choices that involve our concept of the bottom structure, the biota particularly, the nature of the substrate, partially informed by SASE, partially informed by the experience of the scientists that are involved and people involved with the PDT. And then also, we also have to bring in the needs of industry. And you're right, it's a balancing act. Had we just said, okay, let's just go for gravel bottom or whatever, yeah, you're right, we could have been done years ago, but it wouldn't have done the right job. And it also would not have taught us what we don't know. And that's one of the prime values of SASE, is that it also gives us this idea of what we don't know and what we need to find out. But simply closing bottom based upon the geological structure is what we did before. And we know what we had to deal with yesterday. And I just we've got to do better. and that's what we're doing right now. But it's not going to be perfect, Tom, and we'll need a SASE 2 5 years down the line, no question.
Thanks, and thanks for that, Dave. Michelle, do you have the SASE clusters laid on top of the actual boxes? Those are the red SASE clusters and the potential management area boxes. Recognizing that there are absolutely things that we should be considering, I think it would make sense to appreciate the work of and the time that we spent in SASE and use it as a prime driver for creating an alternative in the Great Cell channel. And I'm not sure, at least with the Lisa and SASE clusters that I'm looking at overlaid onto the proposed areas in the channel, the alternative very clearly isn't primarily driven by SASE. And while perhaps we could consider another alternative, I think we should be looking for closer alignment between the tool that we spent so much time and energy developing and peer reviewing and the alternatives. At least we need to consider an alternative that's more clearly aligned with the SASE output. So that's all I'll say with that, and I look forward to the committee's discussion on this area and these management proposals.
Michelle?
So I think this is a discussion that probably should be further fleshed out at the committee before we get into this at the council, but just a couple quick points to make. The way that the outputs that come out of the SASE model, which let me just put up here, are very much driven by the underlying distribution of substrate type, but at a much coarser resolution. So in this region, these are the SASE model outputs for trawl gear. And really, what it means that it's for trawl gear as opposed to dredge gear or anything else is that it uses the trawl vulnerability matrix we came up with, and it goes depth-wise to the sort of limit of the footprint of the trawl fishery. And so the redder cells here are those that were estimated to be more vulnerable, and that's a direct function of the proportion of different dominant substrate areas and associated fauna that are inferred to those dominant substrates in that base green and red and yellow grid. And so that's the underlying colors. And the outlines here may be a little hard to see on the screen, but the darkest outline, let me turn off the lighter one, this is sort of the most restrictive LISA cluster. And what LISA is doing in a nutshell, it's a spatial analysis that looks at the value of the model at every point. So basically that looks at how red the color is and then considers, well, which of those cells that are high value are adjacent to other cells of high value. And so sort of the reason you get the clusters in some areas of high value and not in others are because some of the high value areas are more isolated. If you sort of relax the threshold that you're looking at a little bit, the cluster sort of blows out and expands. But all of the model outputs and the clusters that are derived from the model outputs sort of flow directly from what we know the underlying sediment distribution to be. And so the way the PDT sort of responded to the cluster analysis was that or took that as a piece of advice to incorporate in our decision-making and recommendations to the committee, was that the clusters were identifying areas that we should focus on. So this analysis was telling us that clearly, you know, there's something going on with vulnerable habitats in this region. We should look at it further. And we knew that what was driving these clusters was this underlying grid. When we got to the point of drawing fine management area boundaries, we felt that what was really more important was not the cluster outputs, which the are based on the really coarse grid resolution of the model, but the actual underlying substrate type. I do think that some of the proposed modifications actually do a bit better job of lining up with this core cluster. So we may sort of solve that problem through trying to develop a single area anyway. But I think the committee will talk about this, and we can make some progress.
Mary Beth Tulin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Michelle. I had just a couple of things. One was I was surprised by the comment that the PDT did not think the gear modification, there was enough information there to know about habitat impacts, because, you know, we have vessels that participated in the research that was conducted in the Bering Sea on the sweep modification with the discs. We currently have 3 boats operating in the Bering Sea that use the disc. Is that better? I'm always afraid if I touch it, I'm going to unhook the whole thing. The agency has implemented the gear modification as a requirement in the non-AFA groundfish fishery in the Bering Sea for habitat. So it's been fully analyzed. I think Dr. Karp is familiar with the research that was a cooperative research program with the agency. Craig Rose and John Govan did that work. They're currently conducting additional research now in the Gulf of Alaska. And I think it would be fair to say that gear does minimize impact to habitat, that the research that has been done to date was not on complex bottom habitat, so there's a difference there, and some of that work is now ongoing. But to make a statement that the discs and the modification to the sweep has no discernible habitat information that you could use is incorrect. So I would hope that that's not really what the PDT said.
So I think one comment that you made that the work in the North Pacific, the focus there was, my understanding was on flatfish fisheries, and they were doing that work in sort of muddy sand environments. And so a comment that they made in the conclusions of their publications were that, you know, they weren't so sure that the results of their work would translate directly to more complex habitat environments in terms of, you know, understanding precisely what the trade-offs were. I don't think the PDT feels that those types of gear changes don't have the potential to have benefits to habitat. But I think in terms of, you know, the vessels here and, you know, the size of their gear and the exact modifications that were developed through the advisory panel, it's not clear if you implemented those changes, you know, how does the, you know, there's sort of a, how does the footprint of those fishing gears change? How does catch potentially change? And those are two interacting sort of elements that we're not sure precisely what the outcome would be. I mean, it's, you know, it's entirely possible that you might implement those gear changes and result in a, you know, maintained catch while resulting in a reduction in the amount of time that gear spends on the bottom, and you have a habitat benefit. It's also possible that it might sort of be a wash and you'd make the gear narrower, but you tow slightly longer, and so there would really be no change in the amount of bottom contact with the gear. Or it's possible you would have a cost and your catchability would decrease to the point you'd actually have to spend more time fishing. And I think for these bottom types and the fish in our region and sort of their relative abundance and the gears that are used here, we don't have those type of field studies that really apply here. So there was a huge question for the PDT of we don't know what we might be getting. Which is, I think, what sort of drove the committee to ask, well, how do we gather this information to implement this later?
Well, I knew some of that information as far as, you know, the substrate in which that fishery in the Bering Sea operates, and it is a flatfish fishery, and certainly our captain's largest concern was catchability and raising that foot rope. And quite frankly, if you don't reduce the catchability in a flatfish fishery, then I don't think you're going to reduce the catchability in for other species that are actually more off the bottom. And clearly, the foot rope is raised. It does minimize, impacts to habitat, whether you ended up having to tow longer. I suppose. But again, if it doesn't reduce the catchability for flatfish, I don't think it's going to reduce the catchability for other species. But I think that the authors also were clear that, you know, the bottom type is different, so you're going to have some changes. So they are currently conducting research now in the Gulf of Alaska on different substrate with smaller vessels, because obviously the Bering Sea vessels, their gear is much larger, and when you reduce the size of that gear, that does raise questions about some, you know, parts of it. And at the pace we're going, I'm sure that research is going to be concluded long before we conclude this. So I think there's value to you know, having something in the document that's ready to go, that has been fully researched and could be utilized. John Garvin did come out and talk to some ground fishermen in the region about the research, and these are the things that they discussed already. So, I mean, I sent him an email this morning, but unfortunately with a three-hour difference, I'm not sure he's out of bed yet. So I'll see him next week and ask him some more questions. But anyway, that gear modification, I think it shouldn't be just ignored, and I'm not going to propose anything right at the moment. I think perhaps later in the day we'll get to some of those things. So then the other question that I initially had before that came up was, Dave, you mentioned coming back in April, and I'm curious what your vision is for that April meeting, what you're bringing back, and what you're anticipating the council will be doing?
Yeah, my vision in April is to lay the whole thing before the council and get it moving. I'd be able to tell you more after the next couple of reports, but I certainly don't want to drag this out any further than we have to, Mary Beth. And also, as far as the gear modifications are concerned, the committee did not eliminate it from consideration. It hasn't been put into the considered and not. So you know, that needs to be discussed as well.
Barbara Ramson.
I just had a quick question. As you're evaluating the different areas, are you also taking a look at potential damage of leaving them, of closing them, in terms of invasive species and the potential risk of not tilling the soil, if you will? Do you look at it from both sides?
So we recently had sort of a data exploration meeting related to the Northern Edge, and I think that's the one part of the region that comes to my mind that where those questions are really relevant, both in terms of invasive species. We know that there's an invasive sort of mat-forming tunicate up in that region. It's found in other regions, but it's pretty concentrated on the Northern Edge. And then in terms of sort of production, you know, of scallops, we have some understanding of their distributions in and outside of the areas and age structure inside and outside of the areas and what sort of the costs would be. So I think, you know, I'm not sure that those kind of costs and issues are something we'll consider for all the areas, but I think it's certainly something that will come into the discussion of the Northern Edge in particular. I mean, obviously, we're going to look at sort of the potential economic costs and benefits of closing and reopening different locations. And I think, and also, you know, other resource impacts, cost to the, you know, the scallop resource itself of opening and closing areas and things like that. So I think that'll all sort of tie in. And certainly what we're going to try and do is characterize, you know, what do we think are the habitat values and the habitat attributes associated with different areas. And if there's, say, within the existing closed area two habitat closure, if there's protection of certain habitat attributes, you know, that's one thing in the plus column. If you're also maybe facilitating, you know, expansion of an invasive species, that's kind of a minus in the other column. And so we're going to have to at least have a, you know, there's going to be no way to quantify that trade-off, I don't think, but at least bring forward some kind of a qualitative discussion of those kind of issues. And that's sort of what I'm envisioning.
Dave Gaethel, and then I think we will take a 15-minute break. People can check out, and then I'll go to the audience for questions and comments. Dave Gaethel.
Okay. A couple things have been raised by a couple different people that have been considered by the committee, so I didn't want to have the impression left out there that we hadn't considered them. To Tom's point, a lot of the Great South Channel is a high-energy environment, So it, even if it lights up, some of it drops out because the disturbance caused by the daily tidal flow through there moves the substrate as much or more than fishing gear. That would be number one. To Mary Beth's point, the committee did examine the gear very carefully and did not feel that it could at this time, with no testing on the east coast of the United States, with the east coast assemblage of fish, impose a gear modification without knowing what the costs or benefits might be, that we need some testing of the gear on this coast. I mean, that work was done with Petrali sole. I don't know how yellowtail or gray sole or winter flounder or dabs are going to respond. And until we test that, it could be very counterproductive to impose a gear requirement in an area that reduces the catch by maybe 80% and then have people towing 80% more to catch the same amount. It would totally negate anything you're doing. So what we did is put it in as a frameworkable item that once we get some gear tests on this coast, if we decide we want to use it in some of these areas, that it's a matter of putting it in a framework and doing it. So, I didn't want to leave the impression out there that we didn't do anything. It's you can't just take gear from another part of the world and bring it here and say, well, because it worked over there, it's going to work here. We've seen too many cases where that is not the case.
Okay, we'll take a 15-minute break back at 10:20.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maggie Raymond, Associated Fisheries of Maine, member of the Habitat Advisory Panel. You don't have in your meeting materials at this meeting the summary of the October 10th Advisory Panel meeting, but we were called together then. The purpose of the meeting was specifically to discuss ground cable modifications and to recommend maximum ground cable length for each location in the that was proposed in this amendment to potentially be closed to protect habitat. And that's exactly what we did. And we developed a lot of what I would consider to be very reasonable motions. And I'm extremely disappointed that those options are not included in this document. To anyone who wants to tell me that we're going to close an area and then framework in a gear modification, I just fool me once. You told me that on the Western Gulf of Maine closed area with regards to shrimp gear 10 years ago. We're going to work on that. We're going to get that area open to low-impact shrimp gear. And 10 years later, I'm still waiting for that. And it's that action to happen. So I don't think that's even a reasonable concept to put forward, that we're going to close an area and then say we're going to open it to modified gear. We made a motion for the Georgia Shoal habitat area to include the gear that Mary Beth was describing earlier that has been peer-reviewed and is in use in other on the North Pacific. Do we know whether or not that will work here? No, we don't. But let's try it. Let's do that experiment. Let's make that area an area that uses that modified gear, and then we'll have some information to know whether or not it is a valuable way to reduce trawl gear impact on habitat. We made a motion in the Great Salt Channel to freeze the footprint. Freeze the footprint because we don't know. There's a lot of variation in what the length is of ground cables used within the fleet, so let's freeze the footprint. Well, that's a habitat management strategy that's used all around the country and all around the world. Freeze the footprint. And we don't have that as an option in this document. For the other areas, we couldn't come up with any kind of information about what the length of the ground cables is because they've been closed for 10 years, 20 years. So we don't know what would be an appropriate ground cable length in those areas. That area in the Great Salt Channel now, that's the area you voted yesterday to open up for Southern New England winter flounder catch. That's where it comes from. So this is how crazy this conversation is. We're talking about you know, we had good news yesterday, right? We're going to let people have some economic return from southern New England winter flounder. Now we're going to close the area where they catch it. We have no, I mean, we don't even have an option to even potentially allow them to fish in there with no ground cables. There's nothing other than a closure for that area. So I urge you strongly to go back, look at the recommendations that we made. All of these motions were passed by a strong majority of the Habitat Advisory Panel. And that they're not being considered at this time is just, it's just beyond belief that, that these, you know, we came together. We came together and we responded to the request that was put before us. And I think we did it in a constructive and a responsible way, and I'm very disappointed that these options were not included by the committee in this document.
Ron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ron Smolowitz, Fisheries Survival Fund. I just ditto everything that Maggie mentioned. We were doing really well, I think, up through October and November through that joint process. We had the industry on board working to get this thing through. And now we have a document in front of us that is just driving people crazy. What you have is a document right now. Could we put up the HMAs on Georges Bank? And I'm just going to talk about the Georges Bank HMAs. You have one option. You know, either if you accept them, it's closing it to all mobile gear. This is something I won't even go. We all know for the last 3 years that we told we'd have a range of options. So we worked real hard, as Maggie pointed out. And I just want to give you the logic of what we came up with. Those HMAs, we have no idea currently what fishing effort is in those areas. I know some people say they could use VTRs. No. What's going to happen, the way we envisioned it, is that when the omnibus, we've identified HMAs, and we've identified them based on substrate and talked about the impact of fishing gear. But if you look at complex habitat, worldwide, live bottom, vertical epifauna, the major threat to that is temperature change and pH. And we're not even doing, we're totally ignoring that. You know, orders of magnitude more live bottom is disappearing every year due to pH and temperature than it is due to the impact of anchors and fishing gear. But we've decided we're going to look at, these are our areas that we're concerned about. But we have no idea what takes place in them now. And when we come up with the omnibus amendment and we do away with the existing groundfish closures as step one, and at some point initiate a new set of groundfish options, and we alter, we change our scallop access area program, we're going to be shifting fishing effort. Right now, we know we have great reductions in groundfish and scallop fishing effort. We know that when you open new areas, effort is going to switch there. The fleet, we have a new catch share system. Everybody's shooting for a high catch per unit effort. So our strategy was, in the omnibus amendment, have an option that sets up a data collection protocol for these five, six areas or whatever areas on Georges Bank are identified as important habitat area. Start collecting the data. In parallel, start a research program specific to those areas to determine what would be the benefits of modifying your fishing gear. So that we would, in a period of 2 or 3 years, have a record of what type of gear is being fished in those areas, how, what its frequency and intensity is, and in a parallel process, be looking and examining other gear options specific to those areas. Then all those measures would be frameworkable, and we would be moving forward in an intelligent manner. That's all gone. It's not in a document. That's really not a good place to be. I hope the council could take some action today, at least to encourage the fishing industry that we're not being thrown under the gear, if you will. Thank you.
Drew.
Thank you. Drew Minkiewicz, Fishery Survival Fund. I wanted to talk to you about a few of the issues that have come up in the discussion. First thing I want to touch upon is the urgency of getting this action done. I don't sense that you all get quite how important this is and how it needs to get done. I understand the timeline discussion is going to happen in a little bit, but if this gets delayed to the point that this is not in place by the beginning of the 2014 fishing year, you're looking at the potential loss of $60 million in excess value to the economy. To put that in context, there was a lot of debate yesterday about, you know, the true economic impact of the measures that you had to take yesterday. The entire value that you were talking about and how much was going to be left of it was $60 million. So you're talking about adding another ground revenue of another groundfish fishery by taking action on this. And if you don't, you lose an entire equivalent of entire groundfish industry in revenue if you don't take action. Because 6 million pounds is what is of scallops is one access area trip, and at today's prices, that's $60 million in ex-vessel value. That's what we're talking about. On the Great South Channel, there's been a lot of discussion. What Michelle has up there is, first of all, there's been a lot of discussion about the two northern areas and how important they are to the general category fleet, and they certainly are. The most southern and southeastern area there, that one that she's just circling, has the highest biomass of scallops by far of any of the areas being talked about and is extremely important to the limited access fleet. So I just want you all to understand that. What's not on this, if can you put the 50-meter contour line up?
Yeah.
Basically, what these scallops are is it's really more around 45 meters, but 50 meters is a pretty good proxy. 50 meters is basically the on-off switch for scallop abundance, about 45 meters really. Shoal of that depth, you don't have a lot of scallops, but once you get deeper, that's when the scallops start showing up in great abundance. So what we did in trying to be proactive and work within the system is there was a proposal by the committee to look at creating one area rather than these four. And so what we try to do is put forth our best good faith effort of protecting as much habitat as possible, but also making it a practicable area, because that's the part of the law that keeps getting left out in a lot of this discussion is this has to be practicable. And our view, practicable is minimizing the impact on existing fisheries while maximizing the quote-unquote habitat protection. Well, I want to be very clear, Fishery Survival Fund still doesn't believe that closures in a temperate environment are a way to protect habitat. That reducing frequency and intensity by increasing catch per unit effort is the best thing you can possibly do to protect habitat. If you do so choose to go down the road of some kind of area management and or closure, this is an area that makes the most sense. The other three areas that you briefly saw that the PET has looked at do not work from our perspective nor from the general category perspective, and we made that very clear at the last habitat slash cat meeting, PDT meeting in Milford just a couple of weeks ago. This area is something that is acceptable to both sections of the industry. So if you're looking for something that could move forward in more of a harmonious fashion, I would certainly concentrate on this area and disregard the others because the other proposals are very problematic from an industry perspective. On the George's Bank areas, we are also going to come forward with a proactive measure working on right now to show, you know, the key habit, scallop areas and how we can best work to move forward. And so we will be coming forward with that because we need to get this in place by the beginning of the next fishing year. It is critical, and I can't stress that enough. Another issue that's come up is the dredge modification. Frankly, there isn't any there. If you make a dredge smaller, you're just making less efficient. You're going to lead to more bottom time. You're going to have more overall area impacted at the end of the day. And so that's counterproductive to any kind of habitat production. And as far as trying to modify a dredge so it somehow only minimally touches the bottom, I mean, the fact is you have to touch the bottom. You get a scallop off the bottom. You know, there were some experiments with other dredges, and they didn't catch a whole lot of scallops and caught a whole lot of fish, which is obviously not the direction we're trying to head in our management. And, you know, the fact is, you know, when you talk about impacts, scallop dredge impacts, it's all in the eye of the beholder. It is proven that shellfish beds in general and scallop beds certainly that are tended are more productive and produce more yield over their lifetime than beds that are left untouched. That's been proven over and over again. And that's something very unique to shellfish, but that's what we're talking about here. And so with that, that's we really can't encourage you enough to move this as quickly as possible forward. Thank you.
Dave Wallace.
Dave Wallace, and I'm the chair of the advisory committee for Habitat. I presided over the meeting, the industry meeting, where we laid out what we thought would be the appropriate things for the committee and the council to do. I am disappointed that none of our recommendations, which, as Maggie pointed out, were carried out with very high majorities of the members of the committee, and we thought that they could move forward, and they were reasonable and rational and dealt with the issues that are upon us. And we are really disappointed that they were not considered, and we would very much like the council to actually consider what we did because we think it was significant. Thank you.
Judd Crawford, Pew Environment Group. I wanted to first compliment the work of the Habitat Committee and PDT and the work of the closed area technical team. And I want to make some general comments that are directed at the what I'm very happy to see, which is that we're approaching the point where there's going to begin to be some integration between the work being done by the Habitat Committee and the groundfish people working on questions to do with areas for protecting groundfish and groundfish habitat, because I think these two things are very closely related. I don't think there's anybody, or maybe almost no one sitting around this table, and certainly people who are on the water making their living fishing, who don't recognize that we have problems with the ecosystem, the marine ecosystem that provides us the fish and other things that we have harvested for centuries and benefit from. The ecosystem has been changed. It's changed substantially. There are a number of factors or forces that change the ecosystem, but there's no denying that fishing, especially industrialized fishing, in the recent decades has been a powerful force shaping that ecosystem. And when we hear from the people who work on ecosystem-based fisheries management, the scientists from the Science Center, for example, they ask us, well, what do we want the ecosystem to look like? We need to decide that because we are such a powerful force in it. Unfortunately, it's sort of up to us to decide what it's going to look like. In 2009, NOAA issued an ecosystem status report which identified the Gulf of Maine Northeast region as being subjected to ecosystem overfishing. We are seeing the manifestations of ecosystem overfishing in the fact that we have all kinds of stocks that are dwindling to levels that can't support the fishery anymore and other things that we don't see so readily. I want to try to make an analogy between some of the criticisms that we hear about single species approaches to management and habitat protection. People often criticize single species management based on single species stock assessments because they don't formally recognize, they don't formally quantify the interactions between species. They don't pay attention directly to the relationship between the availability of prey and the abundance of a predator that we might want to harvest, for example. And I'm concerned that we, in our approach to habitat protection, may be taking overly simplified approach to habitat protection. And I just want to point out that the last couple of decades of conservation science, whether we're talking about land or in the water, have focused on this idea that in order to shore up ecosystems, we need to pay attention to the variety of different kinds of ecological communities and habitat types that there are, and that the best strategy for shoring up whole ecosystems, of which the Gulf of Maine is one, is to make sure that we're representing some of each of these different types of habitats. And I'm concerned that the direction we've gone may be too narrowly focused on particular habitat, hard bottom, which is obviously very important. But it's going to be important to recognize that there are habitat areas that provide things indirectly to the species that we harvest directly. And we need to make sure that we're doing what it takes to shore up the entire ecosystem. And habitat protection, protected areas representing different kinds of habitat are clearly a component of what would be true ecosystem-based fisheries management if we could ever get there. It's what gives us ecosystem resilience. It helps us to avoid the kinds of situations that we discussed so painfully yesterday. So I just want to ask, if we're achieving this kind of representation in the work that we're doing, I hope that as we go forward, that we will, in the work that the closed area technical team is doing and the Habitat Committee is doing, that the merging of those two things, the integration of those activities, will achieve that kind of representation to support the whole ecosystem. Certainly the SARA 2 proposal expands into some areas that might not have been identified otherwise that are important and that are a step in that direction. The activity in the proposal to do some more work in the down east area is also important. We need to protect areas where fish spawn, but we also need to remember that before fish get to be large spawning critters, they are very, very small and depend on different kinds of habitat, bottom structure, and other things in order to make their way into the fishery eventually. And those two kinds of places are quite different. That's my comment. Thank you.
Vito?
Vito Gigoloni, Northeast Seafood Coalition. Not to repeat what Maggie and Ron said, we echo basically all of the comments that they made on that. We're too very discouraged in seeing that the gear modification alternatives are being taken off the table. Just wanted to point out, if it wasn't said earlier, I got here late, we estimate between 65 and 80% of the Georges Bank winter flounder are taken out of that Georgia Shoals area. And it's one of the healthy stocks that you have that are being fished at a rate that's sustaining at least some of the fishery. So closing that area would be devastating, and it would have a huge optimum yield issue with it. And I'd note that that area has never been closed in history. So to the extent that you'd actually see benefits out of closing that, I think that would be a tough sell. So gear modifications in the larger blocks was something that people had thought was a potential option. Closure would be devastating. So I think we just want to keep reinforcing that one. In the channel, most of the structure that those blocks are drawn around are structures that people tow around and away from and avoid. That heavy, heavy bottom is not what at least trawlers or scallopers are pulling the gear across. So what you're doing there is drawing huge boxes around structures that are self-protecting already. So, we would hope that gear modifications in the channel would be a better alternative. And just overall, I think the comments about protecting the ecology and the whole system, I think we've had a lot of discussions early on in this process about huge areas that have been closed that are known to be productive, that have a huge cross-section of every substrate that we have in the region, have been closed for up to two decades. And fishing effort as far as the tow time and swept area is at an all-time low in the trawl fishery, and I would say even the fixed gear fishery is at an all-time low. So we do less and less human impact. We have huge areas that have been closed for 20 years, and we effectively shut down the majority of the fishery yesterday with the low productivity that we're getting. So I'm not sure why folks think more of that is what's going to work. You could draw a line with less fishing effort, less impact on skates, less impact on, we're always cutting those tacks in half, less impact on dogs, no impact on seals, and less fishermen touching less and less bottom has us at an all-time productivity low. That's just an obvious observation. I mean, no one talks about that, but maybe some of these bottoms become more productive when we fish them. Sure seemed that way. When we had smaller mesh and we were taking a bigger cross-section of fish out of the age groups, we seemed to have a much more resilient resource than we have now, pretending we know what to do. So I think the ecosystem is competing out there without us, and that fishing pressure is not what's caused all of this. And the less we touch it, the more we're just going to wait for Mother Nature to take care of herself and give us what little we have coming by if the dogfish aren't eating them and the seals. So we hope that the gear modification stays on the table. The other big concern we have with this from the timing aspect, I know you're going to get into that, is the, you know, the CAT process is sort of coming into this, I feel, late in the process after the years. And I hope that we can really coordinate that and make sure that that effort doesn't end up coming in late to the point where we're not going to get this amendment done. I'm hoping you can assist that committee, which I think is doing great work, get right up to speed and be really well integrated with what the Habitat Committee is coming up, because we see potential disconnects there between what the CAT's doing and what the Habitat Committee is doing. And we're not going to get an amendment that's going to go across the finish line if in the end people thought they were participating in one process and they find out this other one comes along and closes the very areas that may have been the reasons why they supported other alternatives in the Habitat Amendment, if you know what I mean. This has to be comprehensive and integrated, and I'm a little concerned from a timing standpoint that it's not.
Thank you. Alan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ellen Gaethel, fishing vessel Ellen Diane. I just had one quick comment that adds on to what Vito was talking about. Laura had spoken about invasive species, and I think that it's really important that you leave the flexibility into this document that allows us to, if we see that there is an invasive invasion in an area, in one of our closed areas, to allow us to open it up to fishing gear to try and alleviate any problems that may have occurred. I'm not saying you should do that to every place, but I think we need to have that flexibility so that if the scientists feel that it's really detrimental and we have the ability to fix it, we can. Thank you.
Any other comments? Yeah. Greg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Greg Cunningham with the Conservation Law Foundation. I just wanted to touch upon a couple of the things that have been said. With respect to the gear modifications and the process by which that was considered, I think it's really important that the council as a whole recognize what the committee, the Habitat Committee members among you already know, which is that this was very closely reviewed, discussed in detail. The Habitat PDT looked at it at length. And the conclusion that they reached was that while there may be some potential for using gear modifications to minimize the effects on essential fish habitat, to date, there simply isn't the sufficient evidence or data to support that. And as a result, they rejected some of the concepts that came forward and that ultimately came forward from the habitat advisors. We strongly supported that approach. We argued that the council and the committee need to base their decisions on the best available science, and the conclusions reached by the PDT were that the science wasn't yet there. So we support the idea that there should be continued research in this area, but that it should not be a component of this version of the Omnibus Habitat Amendment. It's not ready for prime time. We, in fact, do not support even the idea of plugging into this that there should be some framework ability of a notion that isn't yet completely thought out and as to which conclusions can't yet be reached. So we'd prefer that that be eliminated from the current language in the document. With respect to where the habitat, the adverse effects areas of the Habitat Amendment are to date, we too commend the work that's been done. It's been very thorough. The SASE model provides us with a transparent way of looking at how the conclusions have been reached. But we have real reservations about where we are right now with respect to the areas that have been identified. We retain some hope, given that there is this CAT process. There was this decision to merge both the groundfish area consideration and the habitat into a much more comprehensive determination on what the map and what the management ought to look like. We are holding out hope that that will ultimately improve the map as it looks right now. But the current habitat map is very minimalist. It's based on some assumptions in SASE that point us in the direction of hard bottom habitat. As one of the speakers just mentioned, many of these habitats are habitats that aren't currently fished. Your charge is to minimize, to the extent practicable, the effects of fishing gear on the habitat. If the areas aren't fished, and if the map reflects only areas that are unfished, you haven't met that charge. I would add that as it currently is drawn out, that map will reduce the current areas of EFH that would be protected by more than 50%. So this is, at the end of the day, an amendment that will reduce, not improve upon, the protections of EFH. Again, the CAT process has the potential to significantly enhance where we are right now. And to echo the comments of Jed Crawford, they need to take into consideration these other components, the representativeness of the habitat, for example. And we would urge you to, while pushing the CAT to work effectively and efficiently and in an expedited manner, allow them to do that work in a wholesome and complete way that ensures that this is comprehensive. You know, I would add that the groundfish closures themselves, if one looks closely at Amendment 13, there are references to the EFH benefits of the groundfish closures. So not only does the Omnibus Habitat Amendment currently reduce EFH protections by 50%, but then there will be an additional loss in EFH protection to the extent that groundfish closures are reduced, which we expect that they will be reaccessed. Thank you.
Any other comments? Okay, I think, Dave, is that it for yours? We'll move into the CAT.
Yes, we are completed.
Thanks. Andy, you ready to go? 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 And are 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 you ready?